Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, with the program that helps you learn American English. Today we will tell you about an unusual substance that is helping sick people to heal much quicker than normal. Also, some interesting information about digital music. It's great for the listener, but can cause problems for the people who write and play the songs we love. As It Is coming to you right now. Medical adhesive products are becoming more common. Doctors use medical adhesives to help reconnect damaged tissue. They are able to stick fast and hold the tissue together. But until recently, no product had been approved for use inside the human body. Earlier this year, the United States Food and Drug Administration approved a kind of biodegradable glue for use in surgical operations. The product, called tissue glue, breaks down over time. Bob Doty has more on the product and how it reached the market.
Eric Beckman teaches engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. He says tissue glue was created by accident. Around 2001, Mr. Beckman and a dental surgeon at the university were working on a problem. They had set out to design a tissue regeneration membrane in a laboratory. In the process, they accidentally discovered a sticky glue-like substance.
The substance at the time in the lab was a science project. It was a laboratory material. Tissue glue is orders of magnitude more sophisticated.
Tissue glue is a chemical compound used to make plastic. It is non-toxic, meaning it is not harmful to humans. Doctors can now use it to connect big pieces of skin and tissue inside the body. Eric Beckman says the university researchers recognize the possibility of developing and marketing tissue glue. They knew that medical adhesives and liquid bandages were becoming increasingly popular. But nothing like that existed for use inside the body.
Step one was to find a business team that could actually help us turn what was essentially a technology into a real product and then get it through the regulatory pathway.
In 2006, Professor Beckman temporarily left the University of Pittsburgh to set up a business called Cohera Medical. One of the company's first employees was scientist Dottie Clower. She had worked in the Office of Enterprise Development at the University of Pittsburgh. She had advised Mr. Beckman about making his technology available to others. Now she was given the responsibility of product development.
I think that one of the things that made this an attractive business opportunity was, in some ways, the simplicity of the idea. This was simply a glue that you could use inside the body, and everyone understood that.
Cohera Medical raised $75 million to bring tissue glue to market. Tests showed it was strong, safe, and effective. Surgeons use a handheld device to control the even release of glue. Professor Beckman says the Food and Drug Administration approved the glue for connecting large skin flaps in an operation that removes extra fat and skin. He says the product also helps reduce fluid buildup by holding tissues close together. The new glue also means fewer medical problems and a quicker recovery for the patient. In Europe, tissue glue has been approved for use in breast cancer and lymph node dissection surgeries. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. People can listen to music on many devices, including tablets and mobile phones. As music becomes digital, billions of people around the world can listen to many different kinds of songs, no matter where they live. The variety and quantity of music is greater than ever before, and available to more people. These changes are both good news and bad news for the music industry. They help spread music around the world. But as Christopher Jones Cruz tells us, digitizing music can create problems for songwriters, musicians, and singers.
Recently, the music industry observed World Intellectual Property Day. Intellectual property includes books, songs, art, business methods, and other works that humans have created from their intellect. Jimmy Moore is a singer, songwriter, and poet from Houston, Texas. He calls himself J. Metro. He says intellectual property laws protect his music.
Because it's copyrighted, I know that you all can hear it and record it, put it on YouTube, wherever. It doesn't matter. Just spread it all throughout the world, and I feel completely safe and confident knowing that no one else is going to take the music that I've worked so hard to create.
J. Metro told VOA he likes the opportunities new technologies give him and other artists. But he says those technologies can also hurt artists.
However, at the same time, I feel that under the current system, artists aren't being fairly compensated. So it makes it difficult to continue to be able to fund our creativity. But ultimately, it's great to have the exposure.
Michelle Woods directs the Copyright Division of the World Intellectual Property Organization. She says international copyright law agreements have been changed to deal with the digitization of music. She says singers and musicians should be able to earn money when their digitized songs and music are played. She says artists earn less money now than when their songs were played only on radio stations. Alexander Lombard listens to music online. He says young people do not want to pay to listen to digitized songs.
We have the opportunity to access almost every piece of music that ever existed. For my generation, music has always been available for free. Some way or another, you could access free music on the internet.
Even though many songs can be downloaded without payment, the number of digitized songs that are being paid for is increasing. The music industry says sales overall grew almost 7%. To $6.85 billion last year. About half of those sales came from digitized songs, and the other half from music sold in stores. Last year is the first time digital sales and store sales were equal. Chris Ancliffe is a top international lawyer at Warner Music Group, one of the largest record companies in the world. He says experts have often predicted the music business would soon die, but it has always survived. Didier Awadi is a rapper from Senegal. He says African governments must create legal systems that will protect artists' rights. He spoke to VOA through an interpreter.
And so what we want to do is see to it in all of our countries we can strike deals that are fair, that are equitable. We're connected to the world. Let's make sure the legal framework is there.
Experts believe musical creativity will increase because of the Internet, but only if the artists are paid for their work. they say people should realize that if they continue to listen to music without paying for it, it may hurt the artists they like to hear and may someday limit the variety of music that is created. They say if musicians are not rewarded for their work, everyone will suffer. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Not many people consider a bacterium that makes millions of people sick a friend. But scientist Roy Curtis does.
Yeah, I'm always looking for new uses for a bug that most people think is an enemy, and it's my friend. And I would like to make it your friend, too.
Roy Curtis is a microbiologist at the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University. He uses the word bug, a common expression for a germ or virus, when talking about Salmonella bacteria. Mr. Curtis studies Salmonella and thinks it gets a bad rap. In other words, many people only have bad thoughts when they hear the word Salmonella. Salmonella is the most common bacteria to harm or contaminate food. It is found in undercooked meats, eggs, and milk. Salmonella can cause a higher than normal body temperature and pain in the abdomen. The person may feel sick, throwing up whatever is in the stomach. One form of Salmonella is also responsible for the disease typhoid. So, it is only natural that a bacterium that makes people sick is given a bad rap. The question is, when does a foodborne bacterium become your friend? The answer, when it helps to kill cancer cells. Millions of people are sickened each year by Salmonella, but a genetically engineered version of the bacteria may someday be used as a weapon against cancer. As the old saying goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Researchers in the United States and Germany have turned Salmonella into a weapon against cancerous tumors. Roy Curtis says the bacteria can make the cancer cells disappear. And here is the experiment. First, the researchers changed the genes of the Salmonella to die in healthy tissues, but kill cancer cells. They put human cancer cells into mice. Then, he says, they put the genetically modified Salmonella bacteria into the animals.
We genetically modify the Salmonella so that it is unable to survive in healthy tissues, but has a preferential homing to tumors, which is a very nutrient-rich environment where they grow like crazy, and in so doing, kill the cancer cells within the tumor.
Roy Curtis says it will be a while before the genetically modified version of Salmonella is tested on human beings. He wants to make more changes to the bacteria to increase their cancer-killing power. Salmonella would not be a standalone treatment for fighting cancer. Instead, Mr. Curtis hopes the genetically modified bacteria will be used in addition to more traditional therapies, such as chemotherapy and radiation. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's first 3 months as president was one of the most exciting periods in American politics. Roosevelt entered the White House in March 1933. The nation was in crisis. Banks across the country had closed their doors. The Great Economic Depression was at its lowest point. Roosevelt and the Congress moved quickly to help people with little food or money. They launched a series of major economic programs. I'm Doug Johnson with Mario Ritter. This week in our series, we talk about the laws and policies of President Franklin Roosevelt, including those known as the Second New Deal.
Conditions improved within a year after Roosevelt took office. There was no question about that. Banks were open. More people had jobs. Farmers were doing better. And poor people were not so close to disaster as before. However, conditions were far from perfect. 10 million workers still did not have jobs. Young people leaving school were lucky to find any job at all. And most business owners were only earning small profits, if any at all. After the worst crisis was past, some groups of Americans began to attack Roosevelt and his programs. Conservatives were the first to break with the president. They accused Roosevelt of socialist economic policies.
Much more serious to Roosevelt was criticism from reformers within his own party. A number of popular leaders with strong ideas began to attract support from large numbers of Americans. Roosevelt saw his national unity falling apart. Conservatives were accusing him of socialism. Leftist opponents said he was doing too little to end the Depression. He saw that he had to change his path. Roosevelt knew he had little chance to regain the support of conservative Americans. His policies were too progressive. So, halfway through his first term as president, he began to support new reforms in an effort to win more support from the left.
The Supreme Court made the president's efforts easier. Early in 1935, the court ruled that several of Roosevelt's earlier programs violated the Constitution and ordered an end to them. Among them were major programs for farmers and industrial planning. The court's decisions forced Roosevelt to create new programs and try new ideas. One of his first new actions was to support a plan for government controls on companies that supplied water and produced electricity. Another was a measure to give jobs to workers. A third new law forced companies doing business with the federal government to pay workers a minimum wage. And the government also began enforcing a new law to control the actions of stock market traders and investment companies. At the same time, Roosevelt began to attack large companies. He spoke about the importance of small businesses in a democracy. He warned the nation that large companies had too much power. And he called for new actions to increase business competition and control large companies.
Roosevelt supported and Congress passed two laws during this period that would change the lives of working Americans for years to come. The first law gave more power to labor unions. The second created a federal system to provide money for workers after they retired. Roosevelt's administration had already supported labor unions in an earlier law, but that law was overruled by the Supreme Court. So, in 1935, the Congress passed a new law called the National Labor Relations Act. The act created a National Labor Relations Group to help negotiate agreements between workers and business owners. It gave all workers the right to join or form a labor union, and it ordered business owners to negotiate with a union if it represented most of the workers. The new law, for the first time, gave unions real power and negotiating rights.
The other very important law passed during this period created the National Social Security System. The law forced every worker and business owner to pay a small amount of money each month to the federal government. In exchange, the government paid money to workers who had retired or lost their jobs. The new law did not serve everyone. Farmers, government workers, and a number of other groups were not included in the system. The plan also did nothing to help people who were already unemployed. A person had to have a job after the new system began and then lose it to get money. However, the National Social Security Law established a system that would grow and become a central part of American life.
Roosevelt also supported other new laws during this period that changed the American economy. A banking act gave the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, new power to control the total amount of money in use. Another law increased taxes for rich people. A third law limited the power of major companies to gain control of local electric utility companies. The new laws openly challenged the power of big companies, big banks, and big money. Roosevelt rejected the idea that government should cooperate with major companies. Instead, he accused many of the companies of ruining the economy and hurting the working man. He called on Congress to help small companies and the average American.
Perhaps the most important change during this period was that Roosevelt became willing to accept a federal budget that was not balanced. He began to agree with the ideas of Mariner Eccles, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. Eccles believed that government had a duty to spend extra money during times of economic crisis. The extra money, he said, would create jobs for more people. They could buy more goods, and this would increase economic growth. Eccles believed that it was good policy for a government to spend more money than it earned through taxes during such periods. He argued that a growing economy would increase wages and bring in more tax money.
Roosevelt's administration had spent more money than it earned ever since it took office. But the president and his advisors did so only to end the economic crisis. They believed that it was a necessary evil. But Eccles and others told Roosevelt that it was not bad for the nation if the government spent more than it earned. The British economist John Maynard Keynes published an influential book that supported the same policy. And Roosevelt and his top advisors began to accept the new idea.
Roosevelt's economic policies were known as the New Deal. But the many changes he made during this period became known as the Second New Deal. They included some of the most important pieces of legislation in the history of the country, such as the National Labor Relations Act and the Social Security Law. And Roosevelt's willingness to accept an unbalanced budget would be the first step toward federal budget deficits that would grow steadily in the years to come. Budget deficits would jump under President Lyndon Johnson during the war in Vietnam. They would be an important cause of economic inflation in the United States and the world in the 1970s. And Americans would elect Ronald Reagan president in 1980, partly to try to bring federal spending under control. In 1935, however, most Americans agreed with Franklin Roosevelt that budget deficits were necessary to fight the serious economic depression.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. I'm Doug Johnson with Mario Ritter. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.